We're continuing our series called In the Beginning Was the Word, and we're thinking about Christ's pre-existence before Bethlehem. The fact that he walked the earth for the 33 years, when he was born in Bethlehem about 2,000 years ago, he was in some way existent before that time. It's something that's quite mysterious to us. We can't explain everything about it, but we do get some glimpses of at least some aspects of the visible manifestations of God in the Old Testament. And that's really what we've begun to do from last week, and which we'll continue tonight and probably the next at least 2 weeks, which will bring us close to a finish of the series. Now, so far, this has been a fairly clinical, if you like, look at these appearances, and it's just really an observation. I'm just attempting to show you these verses and how they illustrate what was happening there. It's really when we get a little bit further down the track in the scriptural narrative that I think we can gather some other quite profound lessons from these encounters. But I think it's important that we just establish this as taking place first. Genesis 12, verse 1 says, "Now the Lord had said to Abram, 'Get out of your country, from your kindred, from your father's house,' and so on, 'to a land that I'll show you,'" etc., etc. Did you notice the first phrase? Jehovah had said to Abram. Now, Abram had encountered Jehovah sometime previously, and it may well have been 70 odd years before. We don't know. We just don't know. But it does seem as if he had had a conversation sometime before. Abram had hung around the location of Haran and waited for his father to die and then proceeded into the land of Canaan. And we read verse 4, "So Abram departed as Jehovah had spoken to him, and Lot went with him." And the narrative goes on and travels to a few different places. But then we read in verse 7, "Then the Lord appeared to Abram and said, 'To your descendants I will give this land.' And there he built an altar to the Lord, who had appeared to him." Now there's a couple of different points I want to make there. I think by Abraham's time, the fact that the narrative says the Lord appeared to him, and the fact that Abraham built an altar to almost commemorate this act, to me illustrates a shift, that Jehovah was not as frequently present as he had been in those previous times. I like particularly the Hebrew of these words. When we read the English, it's fairly matter-of-fact. It says, "Jehovah appeared to Abram." And then later on the verse, it says, "Abram, he built an altar to Jehovah who had appeared to him." All right, so he just, as if he had just made himself seen. And I think that is actually what happened. The Hebrew really emphasizes things from the other aspect. It's in the Niphal form. I don't want to bore you too much, but these things do make a difference. And really, I think a better translation is that Jehovah was seen by Abraham. He was seen by Abraham. I mean, it's putting the emphasis back on Abram. Abram actually saw this revelation of God. It's like I said, there's a lot of overlap. It's almost the same thing, but the emphasis is on Abraham, who saw him. And then later on in that verse, it says he built an altar to Jehovah who had appeared to him. And literally, it is, he built an altar to Jehovah, the one who had become visible. The one who had become visible. It's a participle. It's in a particular form called the Niphal form of the word. And I think that's a more literal way of actually writing it. So I hope you see the slightly different nuance there. The invisible God became visible at times. He did become visible at times. All right, let's go to Genesis 18 now. I'd like you to have a look at the beginning of chapter 18. These two chapters, 18 and 19, go together. But we're not going to read all the verses in them. I'm just going to pick out a few verses. And it starts by saying, verse 1, "Then Jehovah appeared to him," this is Abraham, "he appeared to him by the terebinth trees of Mamre, as he was sitting in the tent door in the heat of the day. So he lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, Three men were standing by him, and when he saw them, he ran from the tent door to meet them, and bowed himself to the ground. When we say, he said he saw three men. Now, it's going to come to light that two of these men, I'm using the word in quotations, men, quote unquote, two of these men were angels, and one of them is a manifestation of Jehovah. But they all look like people. Have a think about it and see as we go. You might have a comment or two to make. But that's very much how it comes over to me. Two of these beings who look like men were actually angels, and one of them was Jehovah. Then Jehovah appeared to him by the terebinth trees of Mamre as he was sitting in the tent door in the heat of the day. So he lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, three men were standing by him. And when he saw them, he ran from the tent door to meet them and bowed himself to the ground. And he had some idea, I think, of who he was meeting here. And said, "My Lord," notice that Lord is not in capital or semi-capitalized letters. This is, really just means it's a term of respect. Sir, Master, Your Majesty, however you want to say it, it's a term of respect. "My Lord, if I have now found favour in your sight, do not pass on by your servant. Please let a little water be brought and wash your feet and rest yourselves under the tree." So these men had feet. "And I will bring a morsel of bread that you may refresh your hearts." So in a moment these people are going to eat as well. They must have had stomachs, must have had mouths, must have had stomachs. "After that you pass by, inasmuch as you have come to your servant." And they said, "Do as you have said." So Abraham hastened into the tent to Sarah and said, "Quickly, make ready 3 measures of fine meal, knead it and make cakes." This is just normal food, isn't it? And Abraham ran to the herd, took a tender and good calf, gave it to a young man. He hastened to prepare it. He took butter and milk and the calf which he prepared, set it before them, and he stood by them under the tree as they ate. You get the point. It's going to come to light that there's two angels and a manifestation of Jehovah here, and they've taken on human form, quite human characteristics. Remember, our subject is the image of the invisible God. Verse 9. "Then they said to him, 'Where is Sarah, your wife?' He said, 'Here in the tent.' And he said, 'I will certainly return to you according to the time of life, and behold, Sarah, your wife, shall have a son.'" Sarah was, this is all relevant, so I'll keep reading. "Sarah was listening in the tent door which was behind him. Now Abraham and Sarah were old, well advanced in age, and Sarah had passed the age of childbearing. Therefore Sarah laughed within herself, saying, 'After I've grown old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord being old also?'" That's Abraham being old also. "And Jehovah said to Abraham, 'Why did Sarah laugh, saying, shall I surely bear a child since I am old?'" And so he's just conversing quite normally with Abraham here. You can imagine they're standing outside the tent and he's saying, "Well, why did she laugh?" They're just talking. Verse 14. "Is anything too hard for Jehovah? At the appointed time I will return to you according to the time of life, and Sarah shall have a son. But Sarah denied it, saying, 'I did not laugh, for she was afraid.' And he said, 'No, but you did laugh.'" So he has now also appeared to Sarah. "Then the men rose from there and looked towards Sodom, and Abraham went with them to send them on their way." And the rest of the narrative is quite interesting, but we'll just go down to verse 20. "And Jehovah said, 'Because the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sin is very grievous, I will go down now and see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry against it that has come to me, and if not, I will know.'" It's an interesting verse, that, I think. When it says we will go down, I don't think it means from heaven to the earth. I think it means from where he is in Mamre with Abraham, going down south to Sodom and Gomorrah, which is on the edge of the Dead Sea.
Downhill.
And downhill too. South and downhill. Yep. "Then the men turned away from there and went towards Sodom." So those men are the angels. "The men turned away from there and went towards Sodom, but Abraham still stood before the Lord," before Jehovah. "And Abraham came near and said, 'Would you also destroy the righteous with the wicked? Suppose there were 50 and so on. And he has this conversation with him for the next 10 or so verses, and trying to plead with Jehovah about saving the city if there's any righteous men there. We'll just go to the very end of that chapter, verse 33. This is after the discussion about, well, what if there's only 40, or what if there's only 20, and what if there's only 10? Verse 33. So Jehovah went his way as soon as he had finished speaking with Abraham, and Abraham returned to his place. It's a phrase we could just read over if we're not aware of it, but it just talks about how he had been speaking with Abraham. Just quite plainly, it wasn't in a vision, wasn't in a cloud, wasn't in a whirlwind. He was just there in a human form talking with him. Now, the next part of the story, chapter 19, verse 1, now the two angels came to Sodom in the evening. You remember earlier in the narrative it says the two men made their way towards Sodom. Well, here they're called two angels. And Lot was sitting there. And there's some pretty horrible things that happened there, and we're really not going to read all about them. You can read about them in your own time. But basically, the Lord decides that he's going to destroy this city. And it says in verse 24, then Jehovah rained brimstone and fire on Sodom and Gomorrah from Jehovah out of the heavens. And it's an interesting phrase, that. Now, there's a couple of different ways we could think about this. One way is that, are these two different manifestations of Jehovah? Is one in heaven, one's on the earth? That's a possibility. I won't rule that out, but that's not how I tend to think of it. I think this is actually the angels acting on the earth, because Jehovah is not in Sodom at this point, as far as I can tell. The angels are there, but he is not there. Now, of course, he can turn up anywhere he likes at any time, so I'm not discounting that idea at all. But I think this is the angels acting on Jehovah's behalf. Have a look at verse 12 now. It says, then the men said to Lot, so the angels said to Lot, have you anyone else here in the house? Son-in-law, your sons, your daughters, whomever you have in the city, take them out of this place. For we,
the two angels,
that's right, for we will destroy this place, because the outcry against them has grown great before the face of Jehovah, and Jehovah has sent us to destroy it. So Lot went out, spoke to his sons-in-law who had married his daughters, said, get up, get out of this place, for Jehovah will destroy this city. So you've got the angel saying, we're going to destroy it. Jehovah has sent us to destroy it. And then in verse 14 it says, Jehovah will destroy it. And I think when we get to verse 24, the way I read this is that it is the angels acting on behalf of the Lord, on behalf of Jehovah. And I don't think there's two manifestations. I don't think there's a Jehovah who looks like a human up there and there's one down here on the earth. Might be wrong about that. It's not really a point we should argue too much about. But that's how I see it, comparing one portion of Scripture to the other. All right, let's go now very quickly to Genesis chapter 26 and note something about Isaac, Abraham's son, whose name means laughter, and that was because Sarah laughed at the idea of being able to have a son, and we just read about that. Chapter 26, verse 1. There was a famine in the land beside the first famine that was in the days of Abraham, and Isaac went to Abimelech, king of Philistines, in Gerar. That's all by way of background. Verse 2. Then Jehovah appeared to him. And this is the same word that we have in Genesis 12, when I suggested to you that the emphasis is not so much that Jehovah appeared to Abraham, or in this case appeared to Isaac, but that he became visible. It's in the passive form of the verb, the niphal form of the verb, if you're interested in following that up, and it is a passive thing. It is, he became visible to Isaac, or became visible to Abraham. It's quite specific. And that's really all I want to just say there. And we find that that reference to Jehovah appearing to Isaac comes up later, especially when he has a conversation with Moses. So he talks about how, I'm the God who appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That's all I really want to say about Isaac. What we will do to finish off our study is look at his encounter with Jacob. And there's some interesting things here. So I'd like you to turn to chapter 32. Now, Jacob, incidentally, comes on the scene, I think, chapter 25. You needn't turn to it. But from chapter 25 to chapter 32, there'd been a vision, but none of these human appearances to him, that I can tell anyway. And then Jacob sure gets an encounter with God which he hadn't banked on. And we read here, chapter 32, Jacob is on his way to meet Esau, and he has quite a large number of people with him. And he splits the group in two, and he says, now one group, you go ahead, and they go ahead. And you can read about that in the chapter sometime later. So he sends one group ahead, and then another group stays with Jacob. And eventually, he then sends the other group, and Jacob's left on his own. Let's read from verse 22. And he, that's Jacob, I'm inserting a few words here to clarify the narrative, and he, that's Jacob, he arose that night and took his two wives, his two maidservants, his 11 sons, crossed over the ford of Jabbok, that's a river. He took them, sent them over the brook, and sent over what he had. Then Jacob was left alone. And the next phrase is quite extraordinary. It says, and a man wrestled with him until the breaking of day. We're not told anything else about under what circumstances. It just says, very matter-of-factly, and a man wrestled with him until the break of day. Now when he saw that he did not prevail against him, this is when the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he, this is the man, touched the socket of his, Jacob's hip. And the socket of Jacob's hip was out of joint as he wrestled with him. And he said, let me go, for the day breaks. But he said, this is Jacob said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. All right, let's just read that again. And he, that's the man, said, let me go, for the day breaks. But Jacob said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. So the man said to Jacob, what is your name? And he said, Jacob. And he, the man, said, your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel. For you have struggled with God and with men and have prevailed. Remember, he's just wrestled all night with this man, who now it becomes apparent that this man was a form of God. Then Jacob asked him, saying, tell me your name, I pray. And the man said, why is it that you ask about my name? And he, that's the man, blessed him, Jacob, there. And Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, for I have seen God face to face, and my life is preserved. Pretty remarkable, isn't it? You'll notice in that word Peniel, a word I've mentioned before, Peni, the Pene, that's the face, and the El suffix is God. So it's talking about the face of God, isn't it? For I have seen God face to face, and my life is preserved. Just as he crossed over Peniel, and we're not sure why that's Peniel and not Peniel, and it says, the sun rose on him, and he limped on his hip. That's Jacob limped on his hip. Therefore, to this day, the children of Israel do not eat the muscle that shrank, which is on the hip socket, because he touched the socket of Jacob's hip in the muscle that shrank. And here we have quite an extraordinary account, don't we? That this man, Jacob, wrestled with a form of God and he was able to survive. Now, all night. And I think we all understand here that if God wanted to wipe Jacob out, or to put it in crude terms, if he wanted to beat him in a fight, I reckon he could do it, couldn't he? You reckon he could. And I think there's a few pictures here for us. There might be many other lessons and pictures here, but here's just a few I've got from this. Firstly, we get that he changes his name to Israel. And this is really a picture of Israel's struggle with God. You know, of course, I hope you know anyway, the story is that God chose Abraham to father a nation, and here Abraham's grandson Jacob, his name became Israel, and from that, you get the family, the nation of Israel. And their history from here on is very much struggling with God. It also talks about struggling with men there, I think, too, in verse 28, Let's read it. It says, "Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have struggled with God and with men and have prevailed." Now, all through the Old Testament and all through really well into the New, and you could even say in present day times, Israel have struggled with God. They have, haven't they? They have been close to him and then gone away, and they've been close and gone away. They've been constantly disobedient. God is constantly stretching out his hand to them. And there is a very much a struggle. And then, the next part of the verse, they've struggled with men. Well, every nation around Israel has just about always hated them. They've had their allies here and there. You could even say right now that they are surrounded by their enemies. And I think there's just a little picture of things to come in this interesting passage. I think there's another picture here, and I think we get a glimpse here of God manifest in the flesh 2,000 years later. This is about 2,000 years before Christ, give or take a few decades, and we get a picture of what God did in coming to earth, in what he was prepared to do to dwell with man. You see here that this manifestation of God, he presented himself in a form that was weak enough that he could be fought with. He allowed himself, he condescended this much, he stripped himself of privileges and rights and strengths and powers that this man Jacob could wrestle with him and still survive. And in a really loving way, that's exactly what Christ did too. That's exactly what Christ did too. He was God manifest in the flesh. And yet it said he emptied himself of all his glory. He forsook a whole lot of the privileges and abilities that he had before Bethlehem. Put them all to one side and came as a man that could, very physically, be put on a cross and could be killed. Now, we know he gave his own life. We know that he breathed out his last, and so I'm not discounting those ideas. But if he had allowed, someone could have just killed him. That's how much he actually condescended and shed for us. I'm talking about shed in terms of his abilities and privileges that he laid aside. And I think there's just a little picture here of what Christ did for us. And of course, ultimately, Christ died for man, didn't he? Interesting though, isn't it? That's a really interesting one. It just really emphasises that physicality, and yet that man was not a descendant of Adam. It was a form that Jehovah took on, a form that God put on for this particular event. All right, shall we look at just one more passage? And this is in chapter 35. Just a few verses here. We read from verse 1. Now this is later on, and he seems to have a little bit more interaction with him now, more direct interaction from that point on, from the time when he wrestled with him. 35 verse 1. "Then God said to Jacob, 'Arise, go up to Bethel and dwell there, and make an altar there to God who appeared to you when you fled from the face of Esau your brother.'" And that's the Jacob's ladder referred to in chapter 28. "And Jacob said to his household and all who were with him, 'Put away the foreign gods that are among you, purify yourselves, and change your garments. Then let us arise and go up to Bethel, and I will make an altar there to God who answered me in the day of my distress, and has been with me in the way which I have gone.'" I should have pointed out there in verse 1 where it says, "God who appeared to you," it's the same form of the verb, I think. I think it's passive again. It's "who was made visible to you." Was made visible. You see, there's a slightly different emphasis on it. You saw him. That's the idea.
Interesting that he changes the name then, doesn't he? He doesn't say Jehovah.
It is interesting, and you'll find this in a lot of the narratives where I wouldn't say that the terms God and Jehovah are totally interchangeable in the narratives, and it doesn't matter. But the term God in those passages where you get God and Jehovah, they tend to be more about these broader, less tangible features of God, and that Jehovah is the sort of the physical, visible presentation of God. in those instances where we get both. That's the way I've seen it anyway. Let's keep going. Verse 6. We'll just skip a few verses here. So Jacob came to Luz, that is, Bethel, which is in the land of Canaan, he and all the people who were with him, and he built an altar there and called the place El Bethel, because there God appeared to him when he fled from the face of his brother. And I think if we do just, you needn't turn back to it, but when he does reveal himself in the ladder dream, it says, "Behold, Jehovah stood above the ladder and said, I am Jehovah, God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac." But he does actually use both words there. It says, "I'm Jehovah, the God." Now, verse 9, we're just picking out a couple of verses here and we're almost done. Then God appeared to Jacob again. I just want to make the point there that, you see, he's not there all the time. It's just these spasmodic appearances and they're recorded. These are special events. Then God appeared to Jacob again when he came from Paddan Aram and blessed him. And God said to him, "Your name is Jacob. Your name shall not be called Jacob anymore, but Israel shall be your name." So he called his name Israel. And it's really just reinforcing what we read in the earlier passage. Verse 13. Then God went up from him in the place where he talked with him. Whether that means he went up the hill and walked away on land, or whether it means he ascended in the air or just disappeared, can't tell you. Then God went up from him in the place where he talked with him. So Jacob set up a pillar in the place where he talked with him. See, another commemoration. Well, I'm going to commemorate this event. These events are rare by this time. Where he talked with him, a pillar of stone, and he poured a drink offering on it, and he poured oil on it. And Jacob called the name of the place where God spoke with him, Bethel. And Beth means house, and El is God. Well, that's about all I'd like to read tonight. I hope you found that interesting, and I hope that you're finding out a little bit more about the God who wants to really communicate and, I think, ultimately dwell with people. And I think this is perhaps the bigger picture. We might even devote a whole night to looking at that aspect. But I hope these things aren't just worthy of scratching your head or saying, yes, I've figured that one out, or whatever. I hope you're getting to know a little bit about God in the process. God has presented himself to man in different ways at different times. There's a progress, isn't it? And I'm not quite sure whether dispensation is the right term, because we're talking about administration. But he definitely, as far as I can see anyway, presented himself in a different way in those first 2,000 years to how he presented himself in the next 2,000 years, to how he presented himself for 33 years on the earth, and how he has presented himself since then, and how he will present himself again, at least in the millennium, and then how he will present himself again after that, wherever people happen to be, and then after that again, when God becomes all in all. I think a lot of it has to do with him just wanting to reach out and be with us and give us every chance and every opportunity to just accept him and come to him and meet with him and get to know him and have fellowship with him.
It seems as if those different appearances or the way in which he appears must be suitable in some way to the particular time and occasion. And we can't always understand all of it, but from his point of view, that must be the suitable way at that time for some reason or other.
Can I give you a theory that mightn't be right? I think he created Adam, he met with Adam, and if God didn't know the end from the beginning, if he didn't know what was going to happen, you might suspect he'd say, well, here we are, I've created this being, I'm going to have great fellowship with him and his descendants as well, and that'll be terrific. But then, of course, Adam bucked the system, and he didn't want all that God was offering. He didn't want to trust God that much. So Adam gets put outside the garden. He's in the wrong spot. You know, he was put in the garden to be with God, but he was then put outside of the garden. So then you've got these other appearances to the early patriarchs for the next couple of thousand years, and that ends in a disaster when you get the Tower of Babel, because people still want to just rebel and go their own way. So God withdraws again a little bit more. You see what I'm saying? He's in very close fellowship with Adam in the garden, then that fellowship is diminished somewhat. And then it's diminished even further with the scattering of the nations. Quite rightly, you can see God come to the conclusion, these people really don't want me. I'm still going to reach out to them, because there's still going to be some people who want a fellowship with me and get to know me. And you see this again all the way through, particularly in the Exodus story. There's Moses and then there's a people, and how they want to know God is two very different ways. And then it's, well, I'll bring myself to the earth in the time of the Lord Jesus. I'll bring myself to the earth. What will people do with me then?
Crucified.
And that's what they did. They crucified him. And when he comes again, some people will be very happy about it, and we read that a lot of the nations will rebel against him. And this is all rebellion against God. There's a theme that just keeps going through. Anyway.
With Israel, well, he excludes himself from everything else but Israel.
And by that time, of course, then you get the tabernacle worship. And if someone wants to have that close communion with God, they have to become the high priest and the rules, and there's different levels. Moses is an exception to that, but he, I think, was already sanctified in God's eyes. But anyway, that's another issue. First time he meets with God at the burning bush, take your shoes off, you're on holy ground, don't be too familiar with me here yet.
Going back to your theory that you just put up a few minutes ago, you said that I couldn't accept this bit.
No, go on.
You said that something like, but God didn't know the end from the
beginning. No, as if he didn't know the end. And of course he did. He knew that Adam would refuse. He knew that the Tower of Babel would be built. He knew that. That's right. Still, and gave them a chance.
They made the decision.
He knew that Israel would reject him, and that eventually he would reveal the mystery about Jews and Gentiles. But he still gave the people the chance. He's given them every chance. By the end of the ages, he will have given mankind every chance, under every circumstance, to come to him. Why? Because God loved the world so much. And why he loved it, I don't know.
I think there is another reason. I mean, he did all that, because I know that. But it seems to me, if he wanted just people to obey him, he could have made the angels be only given them no choice, and they would have been faithful forever and ever. Could have done the same thing with Adam. Could have done it with other people, probably. But he seems to want to be with people who want to, him for who he is.
He wants to be with people who want to be with him.
Yeah. Yes.
And want his love and fellowship.
Yeah. Not for what he can do for them. But
no, that's right. For who he is.
Companionship?
Yes. I think so. Fellowship? Very much so, I think. Yeah. Don't lose sight of the big picture. The little individual accounts are all interesting. But put them in their context of what God is trying to do and reach out to mankind. And you see that there's a lot of love there, I think. Probably the next 2 weeks, I think, we'll look at a man who did get to know God pretty intimately, perhaps more intimately than any other human being, and that's Moses. And there are some fascinating accounts of Moses talking with Jehovah, and we'll look at some of those the next couple of weeks. Again, if we can just keep the idea of why we're doing this, is because we read in the New Testament that the Lord Jesus was the image of the invisible God, and yet he pre-existed his birth at Bethlehem. And I think we have to be careful how we use our terms, but here is some ways that God has presented himself as an image of something that is otherwise invisible, and he's had to limit himself to have conversation and interaction with people.